This is the third day of this October 2011 seven-day session. We'll return to our text that we've been reading from so far, a book called Zen Dawn, Early Zen Texts from Dunhuang, that is the Dunhuang Caves in northwestern China. This is translated by J.C. Cleary. We just about got to the end of we're reading from a section called Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka. And the first of those biographies is that of Gunabhadra. The second is Bodhidharma. We're almost there. I left off with just one paragraph left here. I didn't realize it was just one paragraph, but it's a nice simple one with a lot to it, so I'm going to just finish that before we go on to Bodhidharma. This is Gunabhadra. The leaves of a tree can teach the Dharma. A jar can teach the Dharma. A pillar can teach the Dharma. A staff can teach the Dharma. A room can teach the Dharma. Earth, water, fire, and air can all teach the Dharma. Earth, wood, tile, and stone also teach the Dharma. What is this? Later, Master Zhao Zhou was once asked, "Is there any teaching in the distant mountains when no one is present?" He said, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." And now, the next section is Tripitaka Dharma Teacher Bodhidharma, Wei period. That's the dynasty that in which Bodhidharma lived. Tripitaka means the three baskets, literally. Refers to the Buddhist canon. The Vinaya, which are the rules and regulations, monastic rules and regulations, the sutras, the purported words of the Buddha, and the shastras, which are all later, all the commentaries by masters since the time of the Buddha. It was meditation master Bodhidharma who took it up after Gunabhadra Tripitaka. He traveled by sea to the southeast coast of China, and then he traveled north to Ye, the capital of the Wei dynasty. The monks Dao Yu and Wei Ke served him for 5 years before he instructed them in the four practices. We'll get to that in just a minute. It is a depiction of Bodhidharma that hangs in the little niche next to the water table that is centered on that hallway, the East Hall. There have been so many paintings of Bodhidharma over the centuries. what this one I think is particularly good has those huge open eyes. Of course, no one knows what Bodhidharma really looked like. It was much too long ago. But we can assume that we can take those eyes, those huge eyes, as representing, signifying how open his mind's eye was, how deeply enlightened he was. Just a few days after Sesshin ends, we'll have our annual Bodhidharma Day. It's the ceremony in honor of Bodhidharma. But the text continues here. This text from these caves at the edge of the Gobi Desert that were unknown for many, many centuries. The Dharma teacher Bodhidharma was a man of southern India, the third son of a local monarch. His intellect was very incisive and clear, and he clearly understood what he was taught. His will was set on the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. I'm reminded of a famous Zen saying Roshi Kapil used to quote: when thoughts of the way are strong, thoughts, worldly thoughts, are weak. When worldly thoughts are strong, thoughts of the way are weak. Many people might wonder how it is that monks can carry on with their spare existence without family, without romantic love, without comforts. I'm speaking, of course, about the true monks, the celibate monks of old. It's only their great commitment, their deep aspiration to the way that can eclipse ordinary human longings and attachments. Not to say that every monk has this kind of aspiration. Far from it. We're told that historically in ancient China, most monks were there not out of their deep aspiration, but for other reasons. And yet for those who do have such an aspiration, they're able to hold to that through their life, way of living. His will was set on the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. He perpetuated the seed of the sages and made it flourish. I get almost a tingle reading this original language, the translation of this language that dates back to many hundreds of years, and knowing that the text of the original text was this lay there in those caves. I guess maybe it comes from having visited those caves. It was really one of the highlights of my first pilgrimage to China. I think largely because there were almost no tourists there. It was compared to the other Buddhist sites in China. It was all but deserted, just lying there in its sort of primitive state out in the desert. It's very vivid to me to think that this text came from there. And there's something almost haunting about the language, sort of quaint, old language that's used here. He perpetuated the seed of the sages and made it flourish. Well, this is the Buddha seed that we recite in our Three Treasures that opens the afternoon chanting in Sesshin. May the Buddha seed forever thrive. With deepest mind empty and still, he saw through and comprehended the things and events of the world. Inner and outer, he was clear about it all. His virtue went beyond the world. His compassion and concern reached every corner of the land. The correct teaching was in decline, so he came from afar across mountains and seas, traveling to teach in the lands of China. Those who practiced mind emptied, still silence, all believed in him. The type who cling to forms and fixate on opinions began to slander and denounce him. Yeah, there was, according to the old accounts, there were those who really had it in for Bodhidharma. We don't know why. Maybe just because his teaching was so radical. He didn't say you had to just do all kinds of devotions and all, but just that wall gazing that he modeled. During this time, he had only the two monks, Dao Yu and Wei Ke, with him. Wei Ke was his Dharma heir. That's the name that we chant after Bodhidharma's name in the ancestral line. Though they were younger, they brought with them wills that were lofty and far-reaching. Being fortunate enough to meet with the Dharma teacher, they served him many years, respectfully seeking instruction. They learned well, encountering the teacher's intent. Moved by their fine energy and sincerity, the Dharma teacher instructed them in the true path. He taught them how to pacify mind, how to develop practice, how to accord with beings, and how to employ skill in means. Skillful means is really what it all comes down to in the end, that is with teaching. It's one thing to have realized the nature of things. It's another thing to be able to skillfully present that understanding, accommodating it to the listener. This is one of the challenges of addressing a group of people, such as here in Sesshin, when I give a talk in the Zendo, is that some of what I say will be suitable for some people, but others it will not be so suitable. Advice, that is, practical advice in practice. That's why Doksan can help keep it more individual. This is the great vehicle teaching for pacifying mind. Let there be no error. again, pacifying, this word the translator keeps using. I wonder what, if another translator would have rendered this differently. I mentioned this for those of you who are hearing this as a recording. I mentioned this, I think, a couple days ago. The phrase bothers me because just there's a tone to it that just sounds too passive. This practice takes great effort. And it's not like it seems to suggest that we're trying to somehow suppress the mind or drug it, sedate the mind when we say pacifying mind. We don't need to do anything to the mind. We just need to let the mind settle. Those who pacify mind like this do wall gazing. Those who develop practice like this do the four practices. Those who accord with beings like this prevent slander and dislike. Those who have skill and means like this dispense with what does not apply. Here I abbreviate what is to be followed. The message is in the text below. Excuse me, all of the foregoing, since we opened this chapter on Bodhidharma, this was all written by, is attributed to another monk by the name of Jing Jue. And can't really know who this monk was. In the preface, he refers to himself. I, Jing Jue. But we don't know anything more. There were those at some once in the earlier times who raised the question of whether Bodhidharma was an actual person or just a legend. But scholarship bears out now that he was a person, not just a legend. And then here's where it begins, Bodhidharma's own teaching. Bodhidharma taught. There are many roads for entering the path, but in essence, they do not go beyond two kinds. One is entering through inner truth, and the other is entering through practice. Entering through inner truth means using the teachings to awaken to the source. It means deep belief that living beings, both ordinary and sage, share one and the same reality nature. It is just because of the false covering of alien dust that it is not manifested. Alien dust would mean our thoughts, our conditioning, our habit forces that obscure this nature that we all have in common. If you abandon the false and return to the real, concentrate your attention and gaze like a wall, then there is no self and others, and ordinary and sage are equal. Firmly abiding and unmoving, you no longer fall into the verbal teachings. This is tacit accord with the real inner truth. Without discrimination, it is still and nameless. This is called entering through inner truth. So this seems to be roughly equivalent to awakening, having the experience of awakening. The other, the four practices, are more about cultivating the path and moving toward awakening. This phrase, we just read, if you abandon the false and return to the real, this is exactly our assignment when we sit. Abandon the false means withdraw our attention from thoughts and return to the real. The real is direct experience. It's the breath. It's the koan. It is the absence of thoughts. And this is just about the hardest thing in the world to do consistently. We keep getting drawn into the false, into our thoughts, and find it difficult. First, just difficult to notice that we've been drawn into our thoughts, and then once noticing, even then, to simply return to the real, the practice. It's the whole point of any particular practice that anyone is working on, is to deliver us out of the false back to the direct experience of the moment. When we are simply, purely on the breath, that's the real. That's direct experience. Same with a koan. The problem is, often when we think we are concentrated on the koan, it's actually the koan mixed up with a bunch of thoughts. It's a diluted experience. It's the direct experience, not the direct experience, but some kind of admixture of thoughts and awareness. It's interesting, if you abandon the false and return to the real, concentrate your attention and gaze like a wall. Not at a wall, gaze like a wall. Wondered that too, there too, if another translator would translate it that way. The Chinese language is a very imprecise one. The original may have had the following characters: concentrate, gaze, wall. And then it's left to the translator to decide how to render that, where to fill in those other words. But it's an interesting translation. It points to something beyond just a physical attitude. It's gaze like a wall. There was another great master much later than Bodhidharma, who said, on the outside, cut off all attachments. On the inside, make your mind like a mountain and enter the way. Then there is no self and other. An ordinary and sage are equal. Until awakening, we are so saddled with this discrimination between the enlightened and the unenlightened. After awakening, if it's a genuine awakening, we've seen through that. It's so silly to think that the awakened have anything fundamentally different from the unawakened. All right, this then was entering through inner truth. And then the second is a category of four aspects of entering through practice. Refers to the four practices. All other practices are contained within these. What are the four practices? First, the practice of repaying wrongs. Second, the practice of going along with the causal nexus. Third, the practice of not seeking anything. And fourth, the practice of according with the Dharma. And he takes each one in turn. What is the practice of repaying wrongs? When receiving suffering, a practitioner who cultivates the path should think to himself, during countless ages past, I have abandoned the root and pursued the branches, flowing into the various states of being and giving rise to much rancor and hatred. The transgression, the harm done, has been limitless. Though I do not transgress now, this suffering is a disaster left over from former lives. The results of evil deeds have ripened. This suffering is not something given by gods or humans. That's the end of the reflection that Bodhidharma here is advising us to do. So, when we find find ourselves having been mistreated or somehow suffering injustice, then Bodhidharma says, reflect on the law of causation. There are no accidents. Ultimately, there is no injustice. Everything is cause and effect. Everything that happens is the effect of a previous cause, and itself, this happening, is the cause of a subsequent effect. An obvious way to consider this is when someone who is especially virtuous is assassinated. Martin Luther King, other really remarkable people who at least are widely considered to be extraordinarily good people can be cut down early in their lives, and there's nothing we can find in their lives that would explain why they should suffer this kind of a crime, be victimized like this. We can, in our own lesser way, we can apply this reflection when we feel we've been wronged. It really works. It works to cut through the self-pity that otherwise is so natural, the feeling of being victimized. It doesn't mean that the other person isn't responsible, just that it's a broader, more complete way of seeing this crime against us. It's just a way, it's a method of maintaining some equanimity under very trying circumstances. Circumstances that can really cause many people to lose their center and become distraught. We can also use it in the most limited way, just in terms of our difficulty of concentrating in sesshin. Why do I have so much difficulty? Why are I so much at the mercy of these thoughts? Why do I keep losing it? Well, because you've allowed the mind, because you've abandoned the true and what is that You abandon the false and return. No, the other way around. We don't want to get that mixed up. That'd be a disaster. To abandon the true and turn to the false. We've been doing it certainly for years, decades, but for those who might be able to accept rebirth, we've been doing it for lifetimes, hundreds of lifetimes, thousands of lifetimes, tens of thousands of lifetimes. We've let the mind run amok, chasing after thoughts. How could this be easy after all that time? That kind of momentum of scattering our attention, how can this be easy? Well, since we don't know what preceded this lifetime, it may have also done a lot of practicing, may have done a lot of, gone to a lot of sesshins or some kind of meditation practice in previous lives. And that possibly is what landed us here in this Zendo in the first place. We had enough practice at returning to the real to have gotten here. But I think we just have to work through this what we're up against. It's an antidote to feeling sorry for oneself, really. Though I do not transgress now, this suffering is a disaster left over from former lives. The results of evil deeds have ripened. So this kind of situation calls for forbearance. Forbearance is one of the six paramitas. It's often translated as patience. But really, forbearance, I think, is a better word. It's also sometimes translated as forbearance because it's that particular kind of patient endurance and acceptance that comes in the face of what seems to be injustice. Bodhidharma goes on, you should willingly endure the suffering without anger or complaint. The sutra says, and I assume whenever he says the sutra, it means the Lankavatara Sutra, encountering suffering, one is not concerned. Why? Because one is conscious of the basic root. Basic root being that which is beyond suffering and joy, that which is beyond change. That which is beyond evolving and devolving, progress and regress. That which is beyond the turmoil of the mind and our emotional reactivity. What is this root? It's mu. It's this. What is this? He goes on, when this attitude toward suffering is born, you are in accord with inner truth, and even as you experience wrongs, you advance on the path. Thus it is called the practice of repaying wrongs. Second, is the practice of going along with the causal nexus. Sentient beings have no selves, but are transformed in a manner causally linked to their deeds. They receive both suffering and happiness. Both are born from causal conditions. If we get good rewards, glory and fame and the like, this is brought about by past causes. We receive them now, but when the causal nexus is ended, when karma is exhausted, they will not be there. So how can we rejoice? Gain and loss follow the causal nexus. Mind is neither augmented nor diminished. If the wind of joy at gain and sorrow at loss does not stir, you deeply accord with the path. Thus it is called the practice of going along with the causal nexus. Well, this is based on, of course, the awareness of impermanence, the awareness of flux, that there is no way we can secure ourselves permanently to anything. But we are, as long as we inhabit this body-mind, and then we will be subject to the waves of causation. A long, long time ago, I came to reflect on this when hearing of the great fortune of certain people, great celebrities, immensely wealthy people who are in circumstances that are so wildly fortunate. And to reflect this way is to feel how fragile that state is, how transitory it is, especially in the case of people who have no kind of practice. It's going to pass. Of course it's going to pass. They have this great moment or years or lifetime of blessing that causes them to be envied by most people in the world, but it has no roots to it. They're bound, if they're not practicing, they're bound, that karma, that good, so-called good karma, is bound to run its course and exhaust itself. And we see that too in the stories that come to us of these athletes and celebrities. Tiger Woods, look what he went through. And there's so many examples. There is no security. There is no ultimate security except through practice. And even that doesn't protect us from past karma. But at least as long as we are practicing, we are continuing to develop the ability to move through change with some grace, and to be able to suffer pain, be able to endure it with some dignity. I think of lottery winners. It's become quite common knowledge that almost all lottery winners have their lives ruined as a result of winning the lottery, becoming immensely wealthy overnight. It's true. According to the articles I've read, they track these unfortunate people who win the lottery. Their lives are ruined. Everyone wants to win the lottery. But they said, the article, this is New York Times, some years ago, said the exception is, and this is the truth, the exception is people who give their money to their church. I'm just saying. Actually, when we were when we were in the throes of fundraising to raise enough money to build this complex, I did from time to time have the fleeting fantasy of entering the lottery to make up the difference. But I thought, what are the chances? Suicide is not uncommon, a breakup of families, divorce, ill health, heart attacks. There's an old story from China, actually, I've read before in Taisho, but it's short. About a man who lived on the northern frontier of China. This, of course, was in ancient times. It may have been roughly in the time of Bodhidharma. A man who lived on the northern frontier of China, and one day, for no reason, his horse ran away to the nomads across the border. Everyone tried to console him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" Some months later, his horse returned, bringing a splendid nomad stallion. Everyone congratulated him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a disaster?" Their household was richer by a fine horse, which the son loved to ride. One day he fell and broke his hip. Everyone tried to console him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" A year later, the nomads came in force across the border, and every able-bodied man took his bow and went into battle. The Chinese frontiersmen lost 9 of every 10 men. Only because the son was lame did father and son survive to take care of each other. Truly, blessing turns to disaster, and disaster to blessing. The changes have no end, nor can the mystery be fathomed. I bet many of us here could report our own stories of having reached some kind of a crisis, suffered a crisis that turned out to be, in the later years, turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to us. I hear about those stories. I actually don't hear so much about the other ones, of something that seemed to be wonderful, good fortune that then turned out to be something else. There's a saying in Zen, even strong winds cannot disturb the water of a deep well. Oh, I see our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.